The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We've got quite a lot to get to today. We're going to summarize some of what George Friedman concluded after the mass shooting in Florida on Sunday morning. And plus, we have more to update you on with respect to the historic vote that takes place here in Britain just 1 week from today. There's another piece that was handed to me this morning about the U.S. military and whether or not it's strong enough, given all of the trouble and turmoil that we see on Earth today. The Heritage Foundation had a video, I think it produced this video recently, asking that question, is the U.S. military strong enough? If we have time later in the show, we'll let you hear some of the audio from that short video. And then also, just to build on some of the things I commented on yesterday with the recent trip that we enjoyed in Austria, if I have time, hopefully I can get into that in the final segment today. The impact visiting Salzburg had upon me personally, the place of Mozart's birth, that was where he was born and got his start in the world of music. Of course, he also traveled a lot with his family to Vienna and to other cities in Germany and such, Italy. But Salzburg was where it all began for him, and there's a couple of museums in that city that are situated in the place of his birth and also in the residence that he and his family lived in later in life. I'd like to just give you a few impressions that were left on me as I worked my way through those two museums on Monday. But first of all, will Britain be part of a united Europe? That's what we titled our television program, scheduled for this coming weekend to be played on TV here in the UK. Sadly, though, the TV station's compliance team has rejected the program. I mentioned a little bit about it yesterday. We played the audio from that program on Tuesday's show, I believe, and having previewed the video Monday evening while we were in Austria, I knew that it was going to be a pretty strong program for the station. In any event, they I think it's just too political or too much into the news. As some of you might know, they've discouraged commentary on news and events of this world, even though they've let quite a few of our programs go through that have been more news-oriented. But this one, I think, maybe was a step too far for them. And as Richard Palmer has been pointing out, it's obviously on all of the shows over here. So in one sense, it doesn't make much sense that it's covered on everything, TV, newspapers, magazines, and such. But evidently, they don't want the religious block of programming to comment on the subject or to weigh in on that. I think, though, after everything dies down, well for one, we'll have to do everything we can to still promote the video online and to talk about it on radio and in the Trumpet and so on. And we've got some things lined up already for next week, depending upon which way this referendum goes. But I also think that even with respect to TV here in the UK, once it all dies down after June 23rd, that we should be able to come in after the fact and still point to the signature prophecy. We had a program on that played here on TV last year, Mr. Armstrong's signature prophecy about the rise, the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, and then how Britain won't be part of it. That's just something that we've been saying for decades. And as I say, It's a huge story over here right now, and for obvious reasons. I mean, Britain has spent the past 43 years helping to shape the European Union. It's been involved in this project from the very beginning. And right now, I mean, Britain's share of the EU economy amounts to 17.6%. Nearly one-fifth of the EU economy. And so you see just how significant, how historic this vote really and truly is. Recent polls, of course, suggest that the Leave campaign has the momentum. The Brexit campaign. And again, it's important for us to try to grasp the significance of what might happen as soon as next week, 7 days from now. As I say, it's a pity that this subject can't be covered in front of a wider audience on TV. But the message will go out. We'll get it out there one way or another. God will promote it. In any event, here we are a week before the referendum. And as we noted on that video we produced, you have millions and millions of Britons who are just dead set against moving forward with a united Europe. And this after 43 years of helping to shape the Union. It remains to be seen whether there's enough millions to tip the scales in the direction of Leave. We'll find out soon enough. But many of these people are very uncomfortable with the fact that Germany is the dominant power in the Union. Many are unhappy with the many undemocratic rules and regulations that are imposed on Britain by bureaucrats, unelected bureaucrats, so many of them, in Brussels. Some say that the financial cost for being in the Union. It's too much. The price tag is too high. And then there are those who are alarmed by just how fast Britain is being transformed by mass immigration, among other things. But this is a huge problem. 175,000 to 200,000 each year pouring into Britain. And these are not individuals, for the most part. I mean, there are some who sneak in, but it's, of course, a lot harder to do with it being an island. But just because of being in the EU, there's all that free movement within the Union. Leave aside the refugee crisis, those coming in from the Middle East and North Africa, those coming into Europe. But there are those who are already in Europe, from Romania, from the Czech Republic, or you just go right down the list of some of those nations, particularly in the East, Eastern Europe, and many of them are venturing into Britain to try to make their way, and it's amounting to nearly 200,000 immigrants per year. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Just in today's paper, it's on the front page. UK's immigration unease animates the Brexit vote. And it talks about how immigration has risen sharply over just the past decade. And particularly with the EU expansion heading eastward, where countries like Romania and Poland and Lithuania can now move around in the Union just as sure as people from France and Belgium and the Netherlands and the UK. This article in the Wall Street Journal, it uses Boston, England as a case in point. That's a little community about 2 hours north of London. It talks about how dramatic the change has been in that little city just in the past 10, 15 years. And again, you see it not just in Boston, you see it in the community that's fairly sizable right here next to Edstone, Stratford-upon-Avon. You can go there in the evenings and see quite a few, or hear quite a few Polish workers at the shops, at restaurants, and so on. And it was the same in Northampton when our regional office was down there a couple of years ago. A lot of the cities are changing, and dramatically. It's happening fast, too. You know all about London, the multicultural city there. The journal says the town's bustling, this is speaking of Boston, England, the town's bustling West Street is lined with Baltic supermarkets, Polish delicatessens, and corner shops with specialty foods from Eastern Europe. Many stores and banks display signs in English, Russian, Polish, and Lithuanian. Several Eastern European convenience stores display the European Union symbol on their storefronts. Immigration critics say, this is later on, immigration critics say it's contributing to the erosion of British traditions, values, and way of life while placing pressure on Britain's public resources and infrastructure. British traditions are eroding away. We've talked about this on this very program. They quote someone in the article here, a local there from Boston, England, pointing across the road saying that this is not the British city I grew up in. The British culture, our traditions, our values, our way of life. It's all eroding away, it quotes this one commentator in the piece, talking about just how wise it was for the Brexit movement really to hold off until just in the last few weeks. And then it's been pressing hard, this immigration button, because it knows that's where the stay campaign is weak. Those who are in favor of staying in the EU, they have no answers. They have no proposed solutions to how to fix the immigration crisis. And so now those in favor of leaving, I mean, they are harping on this night and day, every hour on the hour. Look at the immigration problem. Look at Boston, England. Look at London. Where is this leading? Could it happen as soon as next week? Mr. Armstrong was saying back in 1956 that the stage is set. And it wasn't even until 1973 that this economic community or this trade community came together. And yet he was saying in 1956, everything's set. The stage is set. The Germans are going to be coming back from destruction. They're going to dominate this economic and military union in Europe. They're going to dominate, Germany will, the United States of Europe, and Britain won't be part of it. That is astonishing to think about him saying that well over 60 years ago, 70 years ago. And now we're 7 days away from a referendum that might well accelerate Bible prophecy pertaining to Ephraim like never before. And of course, the repercussions from all of this, well, it's going to go far beyond the borders of the UK. Europe's already waking to the possibility that the UK is most likely going to be on the outside. Up until just a few weeks ago, there were quite a few commentators and leaders, politicians in Europe that wouldn't even take it seriously, the possibility that the UK could leave. Now they're saying, well, we've got to move on with the next phase of the plan, with or without the UK. The Telegraph had a piece yesterday or today, quoting one senior diplomat in Brussels, who said that, look, let's not overestimate the importance of the UK staying in. Sure, they've been a big part of the EU economy. But we can still go on. We can still survive. In fact, we can grow stronger. The Telegraph writes that the European Union will emerge stronger if Britain votes to leave. Its leadership believes, as it braces itself for the growing likelihood of a Brexit. The leadership in the EU believes that the Union will be stronger without Britain. It's not looking at this as a nail in the coffin for the EU project. It says the Telegraph has been told by senior sources that European leaders are now increasingly resigned to the prospect of Britain quitting the EU, but are not prepared to offer further concessions. They're not desperate. They're not going to make further concessions. They're not going to do any last-minute efforts to try to keep the UK in. It's time to move on. It says in the Telegraph, instead, they're insisting that the Union will emerge stronger than before if its most reluctant member does choose to withdraw following next week's vote. See, those in Europe, they realize, they recognize that the UK is the most reluctant member. And so what happens when the most reluctant member is lopped off? It's as if they're saying, look, now is the time to downsize. Now is the time to come together. Now is the time to get stronger. All that's prophesied. Back in 1973, when Britain entered into the European community, Mr. Armstrong said that they were entering into a tragic situation. It wasn't going to work. Or he said it won't work. He said Britain would be faced with a dilemma. And he said it would basically revolve around the role of a fundamentally Protestant Britain in a Catholic-dominated United States of Europe. Now you go back to that Wall Street Journal piece about the culture eroding, the traditions, the values, the way of life. That's the hot button issue right now. Oh, there's been a lot made of the rules and the regulations, German dominance and so on. But now here, those in favor of leaving, those behind the Brexit, they're crying out, don't overlook the immigration problem. Look at what's happening to British culture. Look at what's happening to our nation. Now look at the choice that many Brits are facing. It's exactly what Mr. Armstrong said it would be back in 1973. And then before that, in 1956, he says the stage is set. Here's what's going to happen. 70 years ago, he was talking about the coming divorce between Britain and the European Union. Politico had a piece yesterday, too. Brexit could revitalize the EU, says Commissioner Gunther Oettinger. That's what the European leaders are saying. Look, this is a good thing, the way we see it. They weren't saying that a few months ago. But now they're resigned to the fact that the UK's moving out. And they're saying, hey, this is a good opportunity. Recent events, such as terror attacks, show the need for greater centralization of EU power, the digital commissioner said. Recent events show, look, we need more power. We need more centralized power in the EU bloc. And to this point, the UK has been our most reluctant member. Politico says the European Union would develop a new perspective and gather new dynamics if the United Kingdom quits. That's what this digital commissioner says, Gunther Oettinger. Recent events, notice this, recent events like the terror attacks in Brussels and Paris have shown the need for more powers at EU level. And my expectation would be that the European project would gather new dynamics. That's what this guy said to Politico. The EU could develop its security policy, foreign policy or anti-terrorism policy following a vote for Brexit in June 23rd's UK referendum, according to the commissioner. Look, if they leave, then it's time for us to zero in on the security policy, the foreign policy, and the anti-terrorism policy. And oh, don't forget about the EU army as well. We talked about that yesterday. Remember Con Coughlin and his piece saying that this would be a disaster? This would be a grave threat to UK security. A European army? A German-dominated army? It says in this political piece, EU countries, including France, have elections lined up in 2017, which would delay big changes. But once these are behind us, I believe we will gather more power and strength, says this EU commissioner, says this EU diplomat. You want to leave Britain? Go ahead. That'll just enable us to gather more power and strength. That'll enable us to focus more on military and security and foreign policy and anti-terrorism policies. It's pretty amazing. Just think about all of this. Under the light of these many prophecies proclaimed by Herbert Armstrong for 50, 60, 70 years, Germany has risen from the destruction. And they are clearly the leading dominant power in the United States of Europe, which is about to be downsized, and dramatically so. And it could happen as soon as next week. God's laid it all out there for us. As I said yesterday, it's amazing the insight that he gives to us because of what he has written in advance in the Holy Bible. I am God, it says in Isaiah 46, and there's none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand. I can still hear Mr. Armstrong reading verses like that on his radio programs of old, saying that's the way God talks. It's authoritative. It's backed by authority. He's sure of where he stands. You can stake your life on the truth of God. What a difference, he would say, between the way the God of the Bible talks and the way experts and commentators and diplomats speak today. Oh, there's plenty of arrogance and pride, for sure, among men. But they don't know. God knows. That's why he speaks with such boldness. And he's filled with so much love that he wants for us to know, even before it all comes to pass. He wants us to know what's coming so that we can get our lives in order, so that we can live unto God. God says he brings to nothing what the nations plan, but the eternal's purpose stands forever, and what he plans will last from age to age. That's from the Psalms. That's the God of the Bible. He's laid it all out there for us. And that's why it's so easy to see where this is leading with respect to Britain being on the outside, whether it happens next Thursday or soon thereafter. You know, eventually, that the most reluctant member of the European Union will be out of that union. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
Oh,
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course is a distance learning program that makes the Bible clear and understandable. The correspondence course enables enrollees to learn what the Bible itself says about subjects that affect you and the world you live in. This fascinating Bible course highlights and proves what the Bible says about morality, war, religion, terrorism, and other current events, focusing on the root causes of this world's many problems facing man, as well as their solutions. The Bible and this course also focuses on the reason mankind was created in the first place, the way to happiness, accomplishment, and fulfillment, as well as the truth behind important doctrinal questions, such as what happens after we die, the nature of God, the resurrection, the millennium, and other critical subjects. Enroll today in the Herbert W. Armstrong Bible Correspondence Course. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Yesterday, Canadian lawmakers voted to change the nation's national anthem, O Canada. The new Liberal government that's in charge there, they're hard at work at some of these critical decisions. I speak as a fool. Here it says the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has made greater inclusivity a focus since he was elected last October and named an equal number of men and women to his 30-member cabinet. It was the first time gender parity has been achieved by Canada's team of ministers. This is a significant step forward. This leader of this women's rights group has pointed out, and the change that they made, the lawmakers, yesterday, to the national anthem was to make it more gender neutral, the lyrics. One line in particular where it says, "In all thy sons command," they've replaced that with "In all of us command," so as to not offend any women with the line in the national anthem. The national anthem, offended by the phrase, "In all your sons command." It's incredible, really, to think about what the nations of Israel are preoccupied with as the world burns. You know, in the first segment, we talked about those who were concerned about the changing traditions and culture and values and way of life. And it's easy to point the finger at foreigners that might come into the UK or come into the United States or come into Canada. But how much of the erosion of traditional values, how much of that have we brought on ourselves? We've brought all of it on ourselves. And now you have Canadian lawmakers working to change. I don't know much about the national anthem in Canada, except that it's a beautiful song. How far that it goes back, I would imagine we're talking about hundreds of years. But now the text has to be changed to satisfy the feminists. The truth is, we've brought this erosion of traditional values on ourselves. That's the truth. I mentioned earlier about the article George Friedman wrote, facing some truths behind the Florida massacre. He's talking about this slaughter that happened on Sunday. How do we respond? What do we do? That's the question that everybody has. Those on the left say, well, you've got to have tougher gun laws. Those on the right say, well, we've got to close the borders. He says here, Friedman does, but before we answer the question, we must answer a more fundamental question. Was this a criminal act or an act of war? And as he brings out, we really haven't answered that. Not since 9/11. President Bush sent out signals suggesting both. Friedman points out that in one sense, it's a criminal act. We've got to go after these individuals. And then in another sense, he would talk about the axis of evil. Friedman says, are we at war or fighting criminals? And if we're at war, who with exactly? Now you read this, Friedman's latest. And then again, think about what we were saying right after 9/11. The trumpet, I mean. The trumpet. Even as President Bush did identify Iran as one of the three nations in this axis of evil. And he said that we're going to go after all these terrorist groups. They're going to be stopped. They're going to be defeated. That was, what, 15 years ago? And, of course, there was a big show of force early on with the U.S. effort in Afghanistan and later Iraq. But we were there saying that the effort was doomed to fail. We didn't have the will. Our strength would be spent in vain. And we weren't going after the head of the snake. We weren't declaring war on the enemy. Friedman covers some important history. He just puts what we do and how we respond and what we say today, and he put it back in the World War II time period. Imagine, as he brings out, after the United States was attacked by Japan, Imperial Japan, if we would have responded by going after a few, you know, tiny terrorist organizations or maybe going after Japan's Air Force or just the Air Force, just the plane, just the one that was responsible for drawing up the battle plan to attack Pearl Harbor. I mean, as it was, Roosevelt declared war on Imperial Japan. Now, in one sense, I mean, the enemy here does cross a lot of different borders. But still, we didn't smash the head of the snake early on. And now look at what it's mutated into. But the thing is, we were riding within weeks of 9/11 that these groups, Iran in particular, would emerge from this so-called war against terrorism stronger than ever. And look at Iran right now, today. Look at ISIS. Look at the spread of radical Islam. Friedman talks about how elusive the enemy is here in the case of ISIS. He says what Al-Qaeda learned, and ISIS grasps even better, is that the cost of carrying out terrorism is organization. They must accept a degree of chaos in return for operations that are frequently unguided by the center. He points out how that they can't communicate and coordinate these attacks because the one thing the West has going for it is the technology, the listening devices, tapping into phones, that sort of thing. But that hasn't stopped the attacks, obviously. Friedman says, however, the lone wolves are alone only in the sense that they lack personal contact with the higher-ups, that is. But they're deeply in contact with the ideology. They are in close contact with the ideology. And so you have this latest terrorist who calls 911 before the attack to tell them, I'm with ISIS. I agree with ISIS. I'm on board with the ideology. Friedman says this brings us back to the challenge of defining who the West is at war with. The obvious answer is that the West is at war with the jihadist strand of Islam. The problem is that this strand is not only covert, but also embedded in the Muslim community as a whole. And so how do you get to it, particularly when you have a president leading the effort who is not about to come out and acknowledge that it's a strand, a jihadist strand of Islam? It's obvious that it is. Well, it's leading to the clash of Daniel 11 and verse 40. And how is that king of the south, how is that radical Islamist movement going to be finally subdued and brought to submission? Well, it says in that prophecy that the king of the north comes against the king of the south. There is a leader. There is a king. There are great nations involved here. And one in particular, the number one state sponsor of terror, the king of the north comes against him like a whirlwind. It's just a spectacular clash. This German-led European superstate coming against Iran because of all of this pushiness, this constant antagonism brought on by the king of the south. Friedman concludes here, "We must be honest that the war, which has raged for 15 years, will go on for a long time to come." That's the truth. As Friedman sees it, it's just going to continue on. He says, "We can bring our troops home, but jihadists may follow them. All of these things must be honestly considered. But we like to lie to ourselves, and that's the real enemy. That's the real enemy that we're facing here, is that we lie to ourselves. We won't accept the truth." The prophet Isaiah said, "We've made lies our refuge, and under falsehood have we hid ourselves." That's what we're hiding under. Falsehood and lies. And that's the real enemy that the United States is facing. An excellent piece there by George Friedman over at Geopolitical Futures. One last article here from the Daily Signal talking about the Army being a year older, but not better. "Unfortunately, today's Army is getting significantly smaller and is struggling to accomplish the missions needed to keep America safe." That's what this Heritage Foundation video points out. I see at the clock right now. I don't know if I'll have time to play a segment from that, but we can draw attention to it at a later time. It says much the same thing that we've reported on in this program, just about the state of the U.S. military, the Army, the Air Force, the Navy. And as this article brings out and the Heritage Foundation video brings out, these are the facts and the figures, and a lot of this is put out by the State Department, by the Pentagon. I mean, this is what we need to be able to fight a war on two fronts. And we don't have that now, not hardly. It says the Army faces serious readiness challenges, with only one-third of Army brigades ready for combat and a rising aviation mishap rate. When the Cold War ended, we had 770,000 active duty soldiers. And when 9/11 happened, this is what, 12, 13 years after the Cold War ends, we had gone from 770,000 active duty soldiers down to 481,000. And now we're 15 years on into the war, the so-called war against terrorism. And we're still cutting the number of soldiers. Now it's even below what it was at the start of the war against terrorism. This piece here says, "Just recently, the Army became smaller than it was on 9/11, with another 30,000 soldiers to cut over the next few years. And all while the threats continue to grow." That's what the Heritage Foundation video brings out. There's these threats all over the place. And meanwhile, the Pentagon is making massive cuts. The United States government has made massive cuts in defense spending. And you see it in the numbers. The numbers, they paint a pretty grim picture. Look at the direction. Look at the direction in Europe. Look at the direction in the Middle East, in Iran. Look at the direction in Russia, in China. And then compare it to what's happening in the United States and Britain. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send us some feedback or comment on any of the programs, you can send your emails to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Welcome back to the show. Monday, I was able to tour through Salzburg along with my family and my niece. The five of us went through some beautiful parks. As it happens, it was the Mirabel Gardens, I think it was called. It's where they filmed the famous, or at least bits and pieces of the famous scenes from the Do Re Mi song in The Sound of Music. Just a beautiful palace and garden area. And we were there again watching that video on YouTube on my phone as we were trying to find all of the scenes and the background and the steps and the fountains and the statues that are in that clip from the 1965 movie. And sure enough, so much of it is all still there, just like it was 50-some years ago. We had some fun with that. And then afterwards, we visited the birthplace of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, his birthplace, the apartment that he was born in, and then also his residence when he was a young boy. The family moved. I guess the father, Leopold, wanted to have a little bit more space for the family. It was just a family of four, and at least in our walkthrough on Monday, the birthplace apartment, it certainly looked like it was plenty big enough for a family of four, but I guess Leopold wanted a little more space, so he moved across town, and we went through both of these residences. There's museums in both of these structures, so a lot of things to watch and to read, a lot of the musical instruments, Mozart's first violin, and some of the pianos that he played on. And it was incredible to think about the large body of work produced by this man in a relatively short amount of time. I had forgotten how young he was, Mozart, when he died. He was 35 years old. Only 35. Haydn said this about Mozart. He wrote this to Mozart's dad after his death. "I tell you before God, as an honest man, your son is the greatest composer known to me in person and by name." That's what I think of him. And Haydn was a lot older than Mozart at the time. I mean, he's the greatest composer I've ever known. That's some high praise coming from Haydn. And what a remarkable life it was. Mozart, of course, he was taking music lessons at the age of three. composing music by the age of five and giving public performances when he was 8, 9 years of age. And the thing that struck me in going through the two museums that really fascinated me, that inspired me, was the relationship that Wolfgang had with his father, Leopold. The father-son relationship. This is from a book, The Life of Mozart by Edward Holmes. This, in the mid-1800s, was, I think, seen as the definitive biography on Mozart. The first, one of the first, anyway, to come out in English. There were some German books written in German that came out about Mozart's life soon after he died. But then around about the mid-1800s, Edward Holmes produced this work, The Life of Mozart, and it's based largely on the writings of Wolfgang and the writings of Leopold and the mother, the family, and the friends of the family. It's an excellent book. It says here on page 14, the wonder that his talents created and the applause that he received had no ill effects. This is talking about some of his performances when he was just a boy. He remained a simple and affectionate child, free from vanity, dutiful to his parents, who governed him rather by looks than words, and so obliging that how long soever he might have played, he was always ready to return to the instrument without a murmur, if his father desired it. I mean, if his father desired it, he returned to practice without murmuring, without complaining, because he wanted so badly to please his father. He carried his obedience so far, it says, that he would not accept presents, still less venture to eat anything offered him by friends without permission. Without permission. He wanted to run it by mom and dad first. And then here it says, before he went to rest at night, a little solemnity took place which could not on any occasion be omitted. This happened every night. He had composed a tune which was regularly sung by himself at this time, standing in a chair while his father, standing near him, sang the second verse. And then it gives the words here. It's in German or Latin, some other language, but it says here, finally, between the singing and after it, he would kiss his father on the tip of the nose, and having thus expressed his childish affection, go quietly and contentedly to bed. This custom was observed until he had passed his 9th year, for his father and instructor, who appeared in every point of view in a light that commanded respect, he cherished sentiments of veneration, and one of his most ordinary sayings was, God first, and then Papa. That was one of Mozart's favorite sayings as a boy. God first, and then Papa. He loved his dad. Some have said his dad was a little hard on him, that his dad really came on strong with respect to discipline and structure. And he did. But look at what it produced. There are those who like to say, well, Mozart, he was just a natural-born genius. It came so easy to him. And to be sure, I mean, this book brings out, he was doing some remarkable things as a 5, 6, 7 years of age. But look, he had a remarkable father, who was a distinguished music teacher in his own right and wrote a definitive work on playing the violin as an adult. And he taught his son and his daughter too. She was an accomplished musician. Obviously, in Mozart's shadow. But what a relationship. What a special relationship. To sing along with his father every night before bed, to go and practice without murmuring, to obey. And then one of his more ordinary sayings, God first and then Papa. It makes me think of George Washington. He was born 22 years before Mozart, so they both came from the same time period. What a different time period it was. When asked about her remarkable son, George, how did you raise such an incredible son? Mrs. Washington said, I taught him to obey. George's father, August, it's not sufficient just to obey, he said. You must learn to obey cheerfully. They taught the Ten Commandments, the Washingtons. The Appleby Rules of Conduct. We've written about this before at the Trumpet. But those that would say, oh, Mozart was just this, he had the natural gift. Well, maybe he had some natural abilities there. But this is a young man that worked hard. This is a young man that started early. This is a young man that was taught to obey his parents, to honor his parents, just like it says over there in Ephesians 6, verses 1 and 2. Mozart was like any other little boy. Maybe he had some natural abilities, but it's the influence of his parents that really had the greatest impact. It's the influence of his teacher, his instructor, his father, a famous father in that day, composer, teacher, again, overshadowed largely by the greatness of this son. There's so many touching moments in this book where Mozart's growth and development left his father in tears. He loved his son. He taught his son to strive for perfection. Yes, he was demanding. Yes, he had a home that was structured. Alex Ross, who wrote The Miracle of Salzburg, a book about Mozart, he said, ambitious parents who are currently playing the baby Mozart video for their toddlers, you know, thinking it'll just rub off on them. And there is some positive impact, music, and even hearing music before you're born. We've heard studies about that and so on. But there's no magic push button to this. He says, parents who are currently playing the baby Mozart video for their toddlers may be disappointed to learn that Mozart became Mozart by working furiously hard. And I would suggest to you that that hard work ethic was instilled in him from the days of his youth, for even as early as being a toddler. It was instilled into him by his parents, in particular, his father. With that, we will conclude today's show and allow for, what do we need, three and a half minutes to play one of my favorite Mozart pieces, and it happens to be young Samuel's favorite piece as well. My very smart and disciplined producer. This is from The Marriage of Figaro. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow. Turn up the radio, by the way.